from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Craft League of Champaign-Urbana, presenting their 22nd annual Arts and Crafts show and sale on Saturday, November 20th and 21st at the Urbana Civic Center. Open Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 10 to 4. More information is available at 367-9546. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, presenting Cool Lady, The Making of Lady Gregory, co-founder of the Abbey Theater, Dublin, 1904, a lecture by Sam McCready, followed by a performance of the one-woman play, Cool Lady, on Tuesday, November 16th at 7:30 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Jason Croft is at the controls. Just a quick mention that tomorrow morning in the first hour, we will be taking your questions about cars and car care, something that we generally do every season here on the program. So this is our winter show, and our guest will be Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. Just call in, tell us about your car, describe the problem, if indeed there is a problem, and Rick will see if he can do some diagnosis. Then in the second hour, the guest is Stephen Greenblatt. He's professor of the humanities at Harvard University. He's editor of the Norton Shakespeare, and we will be talking with him about the life of William Shakespeare, the subject of his recent book, Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare, a book that's gotten a lot of positive attention and, in fact, also was a finalist for this year's National Book Award. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with writer Douglas Glover. He was born in Canada, was raised on his family's farm in southwestern Ontario. He studied philosophy at York University and at University of Edinburgh. After that, he worked as a newspaper journalist for papers around Canada, New Brunswick, Ontario, Quebec, and Saskatchewan. Then he went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where he got his MFA in 1982. He has published 5 collections of stories, 4 novels, a book of essays, and his novel, L, won Canada's top literary prize. That's the Governor General's Award for Fiction in 2003. He's taught a number of places in this country, and at present he teaches at Vermont College in Montpelier, Vermont, in the MFA writing program there. He's visiting the campus here to talk with some young writers here at the university and also to do a reading from his work. And if you're interested in meeting him and hearing more from him, he'll be doing a reading today at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore on Wright Street on the campus. That's 4:30 this afternoon. And of course, here on the program, as we talk, if you have questions, you can call in and talk with him. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is kind of a lame question to start out with, but as good as any other, I suppose. Do you think of yourself particularly as being a Canadian author? Because I'm sure that when people identify you, they always mention the fact that, well, yeah, you were born in Canada and your writing has Canadian themes in it, or at least this particular book is about Canada before it was Canada.
Yeah, no, I do think of myself as a Canadian writer, and it's kind of an odd life I've led because I've lived outside of Canada more than I've lived inside Canada. And that's a constant source of puzzle to me, you know, and other people as well. But it's an odd sort of situation where, in fact, I'm the kind of person who goes outside the place he loves in order to understand it, in order to see it better in some way. You know, there's a tradition of that amongst American writers as well. And the people that I kind of grew up admiring, like Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Gertrude Stein, there's a whole generation of Americans who went somewhere else to find their voices as writers. And I think I kind of modeled myself on them in some way. And then I kind of got stuck here because I got married and then I got divorced and I have children and I stay here. I think in the normal course of events, I would have wandered off somewhere else as well. But here I am.
It seems maybe it's not mysterious, but it seems in a way also a little bit too bad that he in Canada – there are a lot of really fine writers in Canada, and they write, generally speaking, in English, so there's not a problem of a language barrier. And yet, certainly there are some Canadian writers that Margaret Atwood and Michael Ondaatje and, you know, people like that who are well known. But there are a lot of really good Canadian writers that are not known particularly well in the United States. And you wonder, why exactly is that? Is there some sort of resistance among American readers? Well, and yes. And after today, though, of course,
I'll be much better.
You'll be much better known. Is it a matter of there's some resistance? Is it that there's some gulf between Canadian publishers and American publishers? Or?
Well, there is. I mean, it's odd thing. People don't understand it at all that in fact, for example, publishing rights are sold by nation, by political boundaries. There is, when you sell a book in Canada, you sell it to a Canadian publisher they have the world rights, or they have the North American rights, or they mm-hmm. have just the Canadian rights. If you sell it in the United States, first of all, you sell the American rights, not the Canadian rights. Often they bundle them together. But there's a little border thing that's actually getting very much fudged by Amazon.com right now, because there's a thing in the publishing world, because Amazon can order books from Britain or order books from Canada and sell them here, which is illegal. It's very interesting. But nevertheless, what you're saying is true. And Canadian, it's not exactly a permeable border. And it is puzzling what books actually become popular. It's almost like a sweepstakes, you know, you made it in the States. But you don't know why. It's very hard to explain, actually.
Well, why do you think, do you have any sort of clue why it is that particular books by Canadian writers do end up being big sellers in the United States and getting a lot of attention in America?
Well, you know, Margaret Atwood is a particular case. And, of course, she was educated here. She did a degree at Harvard and sort of understood America in a certain way. That doesn't explain why her novel Surfacing became famous. It became famous because, in fact, she caught the wave of a rising wave of feminism at that time. She wrote a book called The Edible Woman, which was about anorexia, and then she wrote Surfacing, which was about a woman sort of discovering herself against a man, and she just took off because of that, and that was a bit of luck, which doesn't mean that she's not also a great writer, mm-hmm. But would she have been as famous as she is without that? I don't know. Another famous Canadian now is Ondaatje, who's not Canadian. I mean, he was originally from what's called Sri Lanka now. It's interesting. And again, he's become famous mainly on the strength of the movie of his book rather than his book itself. His earlier books were rather experimental. But oddly enough, they were, you know, you could find them in Britain and you could find them in the collected works of Billy the Kid is a very experimental little book, but you could find it everywhere when it came out. I don't understand these things. Hmm.
Soon here, I'm interested in having you talk about the book that won the Governor General's Award, because I think it's a great story. But in the book here and there are definitely swipes at Canadian culture sort of generally, and at the idea of Canadian writing, which it's a funny thing. I think I've traveled enough in Canada and listened to enough Canadian media that I know two things about the Canadians. One is that they enjoy comparing themselves to the United States in the sense that they like to feel superior to the United States. And in this, and also at the same time, there is sort of some kind of inferiority thing going on among Canadians. And I don't know whether it is they fear that Canada is ultimately a very provincial sort of place or what it is. There's this odd sort of thing that where both of those things are going on.
I'd like to respectfully disagree with that slightly. I'm not sure that it is actually inferiority. It looks like inferiority, but in fact what I think it is more is a sense that the discourse of authority, the discourse, the public discourse, the public way of talking about ourselves is not the real way of talking about ourselves, so that, you know, we've had to live with the discourse of British imperialism, but we've had to live with the discourse of American hegemony in the world, and we worry about that, of course, in a certain way. But what we realize is that actually underneath that we're something else. And so that's the root of Canadian humor, and it's the root of that sense that you maybe think that it's an inferiority, but what it is, it's a recognition that we're actually not what people are saying we are. And that's what's more interesting. And that's the root of Canadian humor. And that's the humor that actually travels actually quite well down to the States. I mean, the people who started Saturday Night Live were Canadians, you know, and a lot of humor writers in Hollywood are Canadians because they have an understanding of irony that, in fact, isn't in some ways American.
Douglas Glover is our guest. He's a writer and is here visiting the campus to talk about his writing. He has won a lot of recognition for his work, including Canada's top literary prize, the Governor General's Award for Fiction. That was last year for his novel, Elle. He's also written several novels, collections of stories, book of essays. If you're interested in reading his work, you can head down to the bookstore and see if you can, just see if you can find it. He will be giving a reading, though, as I mentioned at the beginning, at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30 on Wright Street. So you can stop by. And, of course, questions here are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk about Elle, because I think it's a great story. This is apparently based on something that really happened.
Yes. May have happened, yes.
So there's even a question of whether it qualify as legend, or is it quasi-history or what?
Right. Quasi-history, okay. In a funny way. I mean, it's based on the story that's actually just almost a footnote in Canadian history. And it's pre-Canadian history, because what happened was the French explorers, Cartier, found Canada in the 1530s discovered it. Mm. And then there were three expeditions at that time to try to colonize the place. And every one of them failed. And then the actual colonization of the country didn't start until the 1600s, 60 years later, 60 to 50. Yeah, 60 years later. So that's kind of interesting. So this is earlier than the beginning. And apparently on the last expedition, they were coming over, and the man in charge was kind of martinet, kind of a cruel disciplinarian. He got mad at this woman on the boat for some reason. She may have been his niece, who knows? That's one of the stories. Got mad at her, and he dumped her on an island in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, a very barren island called it the Isle of Demons, because there were all these shrieks. Turns out the shrieks were birds, right? There's a lot of birds there. But they dumped her there, and her boyfriend apparently jumped overboard at the last minute to stay with her, and her old nanny was with her. And the boyfriend died, and the nanny died, and she was pregnant, and she had a baby, and it died. And then the story is that she lived there for 2 years and then was rescued by French fishermen, which is an oddity in itself. This is the official story of the discovery of Canada, but in fact, there were French fishermen coming over all the time. You know, everybody knew that Canada was there, but it was officially discovered by Cartier.
So this is a story that has been told, but no one knows whether, in fact, it actually did happen.
There were three versions of it published in the 16th century in France. One actually was written as a short story by the sister of the King of France, Marguerite de Navarre, and in a book of short stories called The Heptameron. And then two other people who were quasi-historians, what went for historians at the time, kind of like modern bloggers is what they were, with as much allegiance to the truth. You know, we distrust what happens in blogs. Sometimes they're very truthful and sometimes... Anyway, these guys, one of them claimed to have actually interviewed her, but that's even doubtful.
So what is it about this story that got your attention and you thought, that's a nice idea and I'll see where I can take that and see what I can do with it?
I just jumped at the idea that a woman had been dumped on an island and that she had survived, when the official French expeditions, with all their equipment and their impedimenta and their supplies, and couldn't survive. They all failed. Yeah. And somehow this woman all by herself managed to stay alive for two winters in a really cold part of Canada. I have to tell you, it's a bad place. Not that it was very beautiful too, but I thought, my God, she's a survivor, and my God, this is the kind of image of human sort of courage and persistence that I, you know, that I value, and I'd like to write a story about.
Mm-hmm. So then, from that point, you had to, I guess, imagine what sort of person this would have had to have been first to get her into trouble so much that the guy said, he just dumped her, and then what perhaps would allow her to survive. And I think you imagine a young woman who is both literate and sexual, which certainly would have been two qualities frowned upon then, and we're not even so sure now how we feel about it.
That's exactly right. There were bits of clues, you know, in those early written accounts. I mean, one, the story was that it was a sexual... liaison that got her into trouble. So that was a hint. But again, you know, the question was what sort of person. Well, if it was a sexual thing, then maybe she did others earlier, and maybe that's why she was in trouble with her father, and maybe she really. And then I discovered that in those days, if you wanted to get rid of extra children, especially daughters, you could put them in nunneries, and then at that stage they were actually legally dead, and you didn't have to give them a dowry or have any responsibility for them. So that was an alternative. So it was either go to Canada or be put in a nunnery. And then at the same time, I wanted her to be open. I mean, in that time, reading is a sign of openness, of curiosity. She had to, I think that one of the ways you survive in a world like that is that you're open and curious, as opposed to coming, the other colonists come, and what they do is they try to establish another France and Canada. Mm-hmm. And that's the recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. And her boyfriend in the book is, I'm going to go off your topic very quickly.
No, that's fine.
But one of the things that also made this, I couldn't get her going actually just on the strength of her own personality. I had to find something else. And it wasn't until I realized or discovered that tennis was a very popular sport in France at the time that I really began to get this book going. And I realized that her boyfriend could be a tennis pro sort of guy, you know. And what happens, he's an alternate character. So he's on the island with her. And what he does is he's just mystified by this place. And what he does is he starts making a tennis court, which is the image of the imperialist, the colonizers from Europe coming and trying to model Canada on Europe. He comes and models a tennis court, the first tennis court in Canada, first tennis court in North America. And he dies very quickly because change is a disaster for him. Whereas she is constantly almost on the edge of dying, but pulling herself back by being flexible, by being curious, by being open to the other.
Yeah, and also because she's helped by the indigenous people.
Right, who were always helping the French until they got, until they realized that the French was always going to kidnap their people and take them back to France. And then they started to drift into the forest and leave the French alone to die on their own. Yeah, she's open. I mean, the reason the Indians help her is because she's actually available to the Indians. I mean, that's the secret there. It's not just that they are kind to her, but in fact, she isn't trying to impose her world on them. In fact, she just lets them impose on her, and that's what happens to her in the sense that she allows their myths, their ways to permeate her.
There in and I hope this is not giving too much of the book, but. What happens after the boyfriend, who's the tennis playing playboy, dies, and her nursemaid dies, and she's alone? A bear wanders along one day, and she thinks, "Well, that's it. She's going to be attacked by the bear." The bear dies.
And has a heart attack or something.
Something like very convenient.
Yeah.
The bear dies, and what she does in order to survive is that she slices into the bear. And gets into the cavity of the animal, which of course is warm. And she doesn't have proper clothing, and it's cold and it's harsh. And that she thinks, well, this is the one thing I can do to survive. So she's there, and then and she emerges. There's an indigenous man who sees this happen and has no idea. I suppose this would be something of the equivalent of seeing a person land from another planet.
Exactly.
But also hooks into apparently a myth of the indigenous people have about a woman who comes out of a bear. Did I have that right?
That's close. It's not exactly. What happens is he's following. He's doing one of those dream hunts. He thinks he's tracking this bear because he's supposed to somehow or other mythologically. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that in fact, and that's an image of how I see the interaction between the ideas of Western Europe as they colonize Canada and the ideas of the indigenous peoples. What happens is that we coming here interrupted their train of thought. And so the train of thought is him chasing his sort of spirit bear. And the spirit bear meets the white woman and dies. And then he sees the white woman being born out of the spirit bear, which as he then stays with her, he's gradually realizing the sort of tragedy. And she's realizing the tragedy of what's happened because his story has now been completely ripped apart by her and a new myth has been born out of that. And so it's an image of the sort of sadness of what happened in that interaction. So it's not that she relives, it's that she destroys his myth. It's not that.
And so though in the process, that's really the key to her survival.
Right. Well, he is the key. He's the first key to her survival. Yeah. Yeah. He's the one who builds a. He doesn't build a snowhawk. It's a comic, right? Because he's one of those guys. He's an Inuit who can't build a snow house. He says, "Well, my cousin always does that for us." So he gets into her hut, but he feeds her and sort of brings her back to life. Yeah. And then when he leaves her with some seals. And
so that, but I guess I sort of feel the sense in which she her survival in there's almost a kind of metamorphosis that yes. happens with her identifying with the bear and with the people of the place, and that's somehow because she survives because she becomes something different than she was before.
Yeah, she's, as I say, she's open and permeable to these other cultural influences in her way, and that makes it sound abstract and very serious. But in fact, it's quite a comic book, and it's also sexual. I mean, what his relationship with her is sexual. In her case, it's always a surprise. I mean, she thinks of sex as being somewhat romantic, and for him, it's kind of hygienic, and she doesn't feel that he actually thinks she's kind of ugly because she's skinny, and so it's very.
She's on the brink of starvation.
She's on the brink of starvation, and. In fact, she's open to this world, and that's just the beginning. I mean, he's there for a while, and then he disappears, and then she goes, and she also discovers a band of Montagnais Indians who would be living on the coast there, and lives near them for a while, and hangs out with essentially a female shaman who has bear stuff. There's bear imagery all the way through. Yeah. The book.
The book is Elle, and as I mentioned, this book won Canada's top literary prize, the Governor General's Award for Fiction, in 2003. It's published by Goose Lane, and it is now, and I think it's a wonderful book, and I think it really is very funny. There's a lot of funny things in it. I guess I would caution people that it is fairly frank in its discussion of sexual matters and other things physical. So I don't want someone to go out and buy it and then say, I'm shocked by what's in there. But I think that it's really a very funny book.
Well, it's the sort of thing that you're talking about. It's kind of funny. I mean, in a sense, I got very interested in what was going on in France at the time. And of course, this Francois Rabelais character in the novel. When she comes back to France, she's treated by a doctor who's known as F in the novel, but he has all these. He's a writer, and it's really Francois Rabelais, and so in many ways the. The taste of the book is Rabelaisian, of necessity. And at the same time, one wants to create the atmosphere that one would think was kind of realistic. I mean, they didn't have flush toilets or anything remotely like that. So the life was grim.
Yeah. At the same time, I'm sure that some people might say, you know, after having read this character, they would say, well, This is not a woman of the 1500s.
That's right, and that's deliberately so. Deliberately, I mean, I have an earlier historical novel, The Life and Times of Captain N, where I have a half Native man sit on a hilltop and look down into a valley in upstate New York and say, one day there'll be an interstate highway here. And the other character says, "What's an interstate highway?" And the guy says, "I don't know." So, I mean, I'm deliberately also threading through a sense of anachronism. Mm-hmm. At one point, she says that the King of France, I was just reading this, I was looking at it again this morning, and I'd forgotten the part where she looks at the King of France and says he's not very good at crisis management. You know, there's ways she talks that are just not 16th century at all. But the reason for that, too, is partly, again, almost a sense of, I want to give the reader a sense of verisimilitude, of reality. But that doesn't mean that I can actually write like a woman of the 16th century. What that means to me is that I want to make it feel like it's real to you or me. Mm-hmm. That is, she's a 19-year-old girl who's of sexually a little promiscuous, a little wild, and she reads books. She's an intellectual. She likes watching people being burned at the stake. I mean, she has eccentric tastes, but so I imagine her as kind of a person of the of our current century, a girl on the street who's from a well-off home and who's wild, you know, and I want her to think like that. I want her to, and so that's, and I think that's in fact the analogy. I mean, she would have been like anybody now. So I give her that. I give her that. Also, I have also a sense, my sense of the way history works is that our consciousness, our contemporary consciousness, is whether we are, know it or not, is just threaded with historical material, and so that we're not so different from them in many ways.
I wonder, I guess, about and there are so many things that can be called historical fiction.
Yes.
To what extent, as a writer, you feel obligated to make this world that you're creating as faithful to the 16th century as possible, or whether you feel that that's really not you've chosen that as a setting, you want to make it feel right, but that you're not, your intent really isn't to tell a story about the 16th century.
Well, that's not. I know what you're saying. I mean, it's a subtle and sort of complex distinction to make. In fact, I try very hard to be accurate, but at the same time, there's certain sorts of things I want to say that can't possibly be said if I just have a character's in the 16th century. She, in a sense, she has to have read everything that's been written since. In order to say some of the things she says, she has to have read everything that's been written since then. I mean, she knows what she knows about John Calvin's theocratic city in Switzerland. She knows what Luther said about this and that. You know, she knows about the historical development of Protestantism. She knows about the history of books. She knows about all sorts of things that she couldn't really possibly know. Mm-hmm. And so there's a certain lack of verisimilitude there. But at the same time, there's an accuracy. When she sees a ship, it's a certain kind of ship. Well, that wasn't exactly the kind of ship that they had in those days. And it's in contrast to the ships that Cartier liked to travel across the ocean on. He liked caravels, and that's what's called a Noah, a Spanish ship, and so on and so forth. You know, I worked on that very carefully. So that there's I like to have this kind of, I use the word flickering to describe good literature an awful lot. It flickers back and forth between this and that all the time. So I want it to be serious, and then I want it to be funny. I want it to be accurate, and then I want it to be anachronistic. I never want it to sit and be one thing. And when you write an historical, again, you say there's historical novels, and there are other historical novels. There's, of course, the sort of costume epic, the big thing where you have people talking in stilted language, and there's that, and that's a kind of. Then there's the historical romance. I grew up loving kind of romantic novels of the boyhood novels of G.A. Henty, and then the Thomas B. Costain, who's a Canadian writer who used to edit Reader's Digest, wrote a lot of books. And I remember Tyrone Power made a movie out of his novel, The Black Rose, which just fascinated
me. I love that movie.
Did you love that book?
Yes,
that's a great book.
I love that book, and I love that movie.
Oh.
Orson Welles, what a ham.
Yeah.
I love that.
Exactly.
movie. Yes.
Oh, man, this is a connection. That's great.
Yes, wow.
But that stuff's in the back of my head, and yet I can't write that straight-faced. Myself, you know. So I write something else. I write a much more sort of contemporary take on that sort of thing.
I haven't thought about that in a while. Yes.
And you know, I mean, the title of this book is Elle. It's the French pronoun for she. But what I'm thinking about is the H. Rider Haggard novel, She, he wrote King Solomon's Mines, another book of my childhood. These are those kind of historical adventure stories that I grew up on. And She, of course, was made into a movie with Ursula Andress in the 1960s.
Ah,
remember,
yes.
Ursula Andress
in the
she was, there's big posters of her in that skin bikini. The fur was amazing.
I think you're thinking of Raquel Welch. Or am I mistaken?
I may have mixed. Well, it was Ursula Andress was the movie.
Oh, yes, definitely.
I'm thinking of a different poster.
I'm thinking.
You may be right. I couldn't.
I'm thinking of the movie in which you played a cave woman. And it was about prehistoric.
Welch.
I think that was Raquel.
And you don't think she was like that?
Hmm.
You may be right. I'm the kind of person that has the courage of my mistakes, and I'm quite willing to go with them when I'm writing.
All right. Well, if somebody knows, they can call and tell us. I'm told. Yes, she. Well, we can go into this later. I think I'm getting a thumbs up from my guy
right.
in the control room saying yes. We're thinking of Raquel Welch. And was it 1 million years B.C.? Was that the name of the movie?
Really?
Yes.
That's the poster I'm thinking of.
That is.
Okay.
But I do. But I do certainly remember.
Yeah.
Yes.
But anyway,
Ursula Anderson,
this is a kind of an outside reference to H. Rider Haggard and that.
There you go. Well, our guest, Douglas Glover, he's now teaching at Vermont College, Montpelier, Vermont, in the MFA writing program there, has taught some other universities here in the United States, was born and grew up in Canada. He is the author of 5 story collections, 4 novels, a book of essays, and this book that we have talked about, L. It won the Governor General's Award for Fiction in 2003. That's Canada's top literary prize. It is published by Goose Lane Editions. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a reading this afternoon, 4:30, the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. That's on Wright Street. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Champaign County and Line 1. Let's talk with him. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah. I have a couple of things now since you've been sort of doing the adolescent confessional there. I thought you meant Ursula Andress in her flesh tone bikini that I remember from my adolescence.
But was it? Yes. Well, I certainly
not the fur, furry Raquel.
But she was in the movie.
Right.
Yes. Okay. We're all agreed on that.
I got that part right.
We're all agreeing on that.
Well, this is a cheap shot, but it just strikes me as kind of odd that the most prestigious prize in Canada is the Governor General's, who is an emissary from the Queen. But which actually does get to me to the point. How much of this is sort of a consciously trying to look into the French sort of antecedents of the Canadian experience, or how much of it is there actually some sort of way that this is reflects your understanding and awareness of French culture because of emphasis on trying to knit the two parts of the Canadian polity together? Or do you get my drift, kind of?
Yes, I do. I sort of get it, and it's a good question in terms of my writing. First of all, I grew up in southern Ontario, and both sides of my family were United Empire loyalists, which is, you know, I grew up in a family that called them Quebecers, and so the French have always been my, you know, mythical other, the dream of knitting the cultures together is always there, and it's completely false, of course. But that's not exactly what led me to this. It's actually a more interesting story. I having come away and finding myself living in the United States, I started reading Canadian history and kind of filling in what I figured were my own blanks. And out of that came the first historical novel, which was really a story about the United Empire loyalists who came out of, in that case, out of upstate New York and ended up living exactly where I grew up. And what I was doing was trying to reimagine a kind of basic psychic traumatic event from my family's history. And I felt that that was really, really helpful. So I had this interest in basically filling in gaps by writing fictional stories about earlier events. And so then I happened upon this woman and I thought that I would do that. It wasn't in particular meant to do anything for the French. It was mostly for me. But the other thing that went on while all this was going on was that I've been very influenced by French-Canadian writers. Probably my greatest influence is a novelist named Hubert Aquin, Aquin, who wrote 4 novels before he committed suicide in 1977. And it was his analysis of the French-Canadian, the history of French Canada and French-Canadian politics that actually drove my own sense of Canadian politics in general. So that, in fact, my understanding that drives this new novel is built on something that I learned from French Canada in a different context.
What, I missed his name. What was the guy's
Hubert,
name?
Hubert.
Hubert, yeah.
I can't. Aquin. I've actually, over the years, been trying to get his books republished. They're of course, republished in Canada, but no one in the United States has ever paid much attention to him. He's a brilliant modernist writer, and I keep trying to get his work printed down here.
So you were, to put a less subtle point on it, your family comes from the Tories, who were sort of ethnically cleansed out of upstate New York.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly the right way of saying it. And ethnically cleansed out of what was becoming the United States, but also betrayed by the imperial power they had allied themselves with. they were really promised. I mean, their alliances to Britain were often based on the belief that Britain would win no matter what, and they would have a position of power in the colonies, and they were dumped on virgin farmland, virgin forest land in Ontario, where, you know, for a long time the people that I grew up from used whiskey as the medium of trade, and there wasn't any money. So they felt betrayed, and a lot of that consciousness I grew up with is a kind of double consciousness, like we're more pro-British than the British themselves because we, in fact, were betrayed by the British. And you see this. I mean, one of the ways I understood this was by talking to Cubans and Vietnamese in this country, because it's exactly, you know, find that the most pro-American communities are the Cuban refugees in Miami. And some of the South Vietnamese people who had to be transplanted here. Fascinating to watch the way these discourses thread through people and historically.
This would also sort of underpin the animosity to the French, too, because the French were, I guess, historically seen as the actors. Now, you're saying the British betrayed by losing, but they also probably would have seen as betraying by not putting support in when people were relocating and all that sort of stuff.
Right. I mean, they did to a certain extent. They certainly gave people land, but it was kind of empty land. They also betrayed by very quickly sort of accommodating themselves to the United States. Once the United States had been formed and the British then began basically.
Well, there was another war in 18.
There was another small war, yes. But they almost left us alone there. And then they gave away huge chunks. We've always felt badly that the British kept giving away huge chunks of the country to you guys. Sorry.
Okay.
My ex-wife used to get mad at me. Every time we used to drive across the border, I'd start addressing my wife as you guys.
And now you live here, so you
right.
Say it all the time.
Right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay,
thanks for
calling.
Our guest is Canadian writer Douglas Glover. He's here visiting the campus to talk about his writing. As I mentioned, he'll be doing a reading at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just to pick up on the point that the caller made about the fact that this award that we mentioned that Al got was the Governor General's
yes.
Award, and he's the representative of the Queen in the current Governor General is in fact
yes
is
she's,
in fact
and
a woman.
She's ethnically Chinese,
and that's also very interesting too, which makes me interested in having you talk a little bit about, and this may differ depending on who you ask about, though, what people in Canada, what exactly is the relationship between Canada and Britain?
Now. Oh,
now.
Well, we have our own. I mean, we now have a constitution that's up until the 80s when Trudeau pushed through what is our constitution. The highest sort of legal document was the British North America Act and its amended acts in the Parliament in England. You know, de facto, we were an independent country, but in some ways, we were still connected, but that's now not the case. But we are connected in terms of a kind of protocol, in a way. The Queen of England is the Queen of Canada, and the head of government is technically the Governor General. It's a bit like in some countries where you have a president and a premier. In France, you have an elected president, which is more of a figurehead than an actual political leader, and that's much the way it is. And the Governor General is not an English person. It's always a Canadian. We appoint her ourselves. But she lives in a palatial residence not far from the Parliament buildings, and everybody complains she spends too much money, just like the Queen. I don't know.
Well,
she's
anybody,
a lovely woman.
Anybody come along, for example, say something like, maybe we should redesign the currency, take the Queen off?
Sure. People say that all the time. I don't know. We do. We've got kingfishers, and we have animals on it a lot now. There's still a little picture of the Queen. Mm-hmm. But... No, I mean, we're not. It's not a country that I think worries about it that much anymore. Sometimes they do, and sometimes not. But you know, it's not actually that important because she doesn't impinge on the country. There's no political pressure that comes from Britain at all. So,
well, I guess I wasn't really thinking about that.
But the irony of getting an award from the Governor General is interesting. And in fact, what does happen is there are periods of time and some people that really irks. For example, my this man, Hubert Aquin, the French-Canadian writer, was given the Governor General's Award in, I think, 1970 and refused it on the grounds that he was a separatist and didn't approve of the Queen. Mm-hmm. So that happens. I mean, it does happen. I don't know what they would... I don't know what they'd change it to. It's a little bit of a word thing, Governor General, I don't know.
We talked about a lot about the book. Would you like to read a little something from L?
Oh, my God. If you have an idea, do you have something?
Well, I guess I really don't. And if, if you'd rather not, you know, whatever. I'm just thinking, you know, folks who are listening might like to have a little taste of what of this book and of your writing. And since you're right here.
Well, just a little. Okay. This is the part that, I mean, this is a funny book. And on one level, another level, it's very serious and it's a novel of ideas. But it's also a book. And you said, as I say, that I take little cracks at Canadian literature and Canadian culture. But that's always with incredible affection. You have to understand that. We get to say things about our country. But at the same time, the affection is there. And there's this moment when she's just being rescued where she suddenly looks back at the country just as she realizes that she's leaving. Okay. So there, we imagine her on the coast at an Indian encampment, and there's a big ship, whaler, that has arrived, and the people are trading at the beach, and she realizes that she's going to be taken away. The dog snarls, barks a warning. The boy looks over his shoulder, agonizing over the orgy of avarice at the shoreline. The fun he is missing. The sun is setting. Smoky lanterns blaze aboard the ship, which looms like a dark cloud or Sorcerer's Island. Just beyond her, a whale breaches, rolling head to tail back into the sea. A cormorant, a black snake with wings, skims silently above the surface of the water. Eider ducks rise and fall on invisible waves. I am reminded of the mysterious beauty of Canada. Peace just beyond the ambit of human squalor, silence split by the call of a bird or the cry of a wolf. The antiseptic and ghostly whiteness when winter comes. Already I miss the place. Now and again I have thought about that monk who asked St. Brendan to leave him behind in Canada. There was a, you know, there's an Irish legend that St. Brendan discovered North America. Mm-hmm. And that part of that legend is that when he came back, one of the monks stayed. So she says, now and again I have thought about that monk who asked St. Brendan to leave him behind in Canada, or as they called it, the Fortunate Isles. What impulse led to this act of reckless self-abandonment? I imagine him, tonsure and cassock, kneeling on the glistening shingle, praying as the odd round ship vanishes eastward into the ocean fogs. When it is gone, he stands and turns with his arms outstretched to face inland, with the whole vast continent before him. Everything new, his whole life to make for himself. Snowflakes beginning to fall, God on the wind. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really good writing in there in the book. I really would recommend it.
Thank you.
Something that I don't know if this is I'm making too much of it, but in the book, Notes from a Prodigal Son, in the first piece, you write about something that happened when you were at the writer's workshop, and the person who was the who came in to be the writing teacher, and you say in this particular essay that this guy was the best writing teacher you ever had. He was somebody from Kansas who showed up at the last minute as a replacement for somebody who got sick. And you said the first day of the classes, he comes in without saying anything. He picks up a piece of chalk and he writes across the full length of the blackboard in huge looping letters, "Remember to tell them the novel is a poem."
Yes.
Tell me about that. In what sense is a novel, if you're doing it the right way, in what sense is a novel a poem?
Well, in the sense that it's a contrast with the kind of prevailing idea that a novel is a story that seems to be as real as we can make it. So, you know, that old workshop saw, write what you know. Mm-hmm. And he was coming at it from a completely different side. He had a kind of... I mean, I make joke. He was from Kansas, but he was in fact a very sophisticated man in terms of his understanding of literature. Not that people from Kansas can't be sophisticated, but he presented himself as a kind of rural Kansan. We'd wear cowboy boots and then a leather vest and talk like that a little bit. he would always take the elevator up to this from the first floor to the second floor. And he said, if God had intended us to walk on stairs, he wouldn't have invented elevators. You know, it's that kind of guy. But anyway, no, what he meant was that, in fact, as opposed to just telling a story that seems realistic, that, in fact, novels and short stories are actually heavily constructed and heavily patterned. Patterned means the use of kind of various sorts of repetitive devices that seem, on one hand, to be very poetic rather than what we identify with poetry rather than with telling a story. And so he was coming at it from the side, well, let's look at the patterns that make up a novel instead of worrying about the story. That's something else. Mm-hmm. And that was basically the lesson of the class that he taught was, we're going to look at each of these novels one a week, and we're going to pull out devices and structures that are essential to this book or that book, and that we might not notice if we're just reading for a story or reading to identify with character.
Does that affect now today the way that you read? Can you just pick up a book and just read it, or are you always paying attention to how it's put together?
Yeah, I am. Actually, yeah. I always notice how they're. I'm always making notes. But I mean, I think comes with the job of being a writer. And I remember there's in Virginia Woolf's diaries, there's one moment when she sits back and says, I don't know how anybody can read without a pencil in her hand. You know, and so that's it. I mean, you're just always sitting there. I mean, it's part of my experience of reading any book is I'm just sitting there saying, now, how's this set up? What's the character? What's the novelist doing? What tricks is he pulling off? What's being repeated? Why is it being repeated? I mean, what's he saying that he's telling me, and what underneath is he telling me? Or she telling me. I think that, in fact, it makes the experience of the book much more interesting. What it does mean is that I tend not to be too interested in books that are just stories. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I love mystery novels, which are just genre novels. So, I mean, whenever I want to relax, I sit back and read mystery novels.
So what about them is it that you like particularly?
I don't know. That's just the way I write. It's like watching television, I guess. You know, sometimes you like to veg out. But I don't quite like, you know, I wrote a detective novel. My first published novel was a kind of parodic detective novel. So, I mean, I do like the genre even that way.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, I mean, going back to this idea about the novel being a poem, that what poems do is that they do indeed tell stories, but they do it in... I think of them as doing that mostly with creating images, to try to just take the story and to tell a story, but to strip it down to the bare sort of nubs of the story, almost to get at you at a more emotional level rather than a more.
Right, but it's also not just a matter of the image, because in fact the emotion that you get out of a poem also has a lot to do with rhythm and stress. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not. It's also the ABAB of rhyme, and it's the internal rhymes, and it's the troche or the spondee or the iambic foot, or you know what? It's all those things going on as well. I mean, the image that the poem projects into consciousness is not just maybe the word or the object that the poem, like an ode to a Grecian urn, is not just the Grecian urn. Mm-hmm. It's not just the meaning of the words, it's the emotional impact of the patterns as well. And that's what he's talking about. So in a book like L, it's heavily, heavily patterned, even though it's also funny and it's a story. It's an adventure story. It's a cracked romance. And it's a comedy. But it's also a book in which her experience of coming to Canada is paralleled with the experience of her boyfriend, who is a counter. I mean, he does it the wrong way and dies. Mm-hmm. The man who puts her on shore also does it the wrong way and dies. She has a dog with her who, in fact, survives in Canada. And he wasn't having a very good time on ship, but in Canada he does better and better. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, he's the one who stays there in Canada. And then and more parallels, but the patterning is everywhere in the book. When she comes back to France, there's an Indian woman living in France to who she befriends, and they build, everything's a repetition. They build an Indian encampment in a field in France.
Just like the way that the guy builds the tennis court.
Right, exactly. And then, and the Indian woman in France, as I say, has been infected with Christianity. She prays in a church, as the way my woman has been infected, as she says, by savagery. That's the way they talk then. And so there's this patterning that's going on beneath the level of story all through the book. Everything everything that happens in the book is an analogy or a reflection or a contrast to something else that's happening in the book.
Mm-hmm. And that is, so as you, I'm thinking of how you talk about this with young people who want to be writers or maybe show talent for being writers. How do you teach a lesson like that about the way that you tell stories or the way that you, it's got to be more than just one story. It's a lot of stories that get tangled up with each right. other.
Well, I tend to teach it by, first of all, getting them to read, you know, and I have a series of books and stories that I assign people in order to teach them very, very specific lessons about how things are patterned in stories. And, you know, the most amazing stories are highly patterned. There's one story by the writer Bobby Ann Mason, and I hope people haven't forgotten her yet. But she was famous. I mean, critics were a bit hard on her. They called her Kmart, what she wrote, Kmart realism. She would write about people in Kentucky and Tennessee. And, so. Mm-hmm. And it diminished her in a cruel way because, in fact, she was a highly intellectual writer with a PhD and a dissertation on Nabokov that was published as a book. And her stories are very patterned and beautifully built-in images and repetitions and things, even mm-hmm. though they're about working-class truck drivers. And you don't notice it, but you feel it.
So what are you working on right now?
Well, actually, I just finished something. I finished it a few months ago, and it's just coming out in Canada. I wrote a book-length essay on Don Quixote and the novel structure, which is, again, me. I mean, I sit and think about this stuff all the time, trying to make myself a more mm-hmm. interesting writer.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
For talking with us. Ooh, we certainly appreciate it. Our guest, Douglas Glover, he is now teaching at Vermont College in Montpelier, Vermont, in the MFA writing program there. Has authored several collections of stories and four novels, and you might particularly want to look for L. It's a novel published by Goose Lane Editions, the one that won the Governor General's Award. He'll be doing a reading and a book signing today at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon, 4:30. That's on the U of I campus on Wright Street, so that you could stop by and meet him. And again, thanks very, very much.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me.
Support for the broadcast today provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign for over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. The program also made possible by Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe and Downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services with a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. That's it for us, though. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the personality test. Journalist Annie Murphy Paul will join us following the 1 o'clock news. She's the author of The Cult of Personality. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. December week trading at 308.5, down 1/4.